Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
call to drop TV's local content quota.
The Parents' Jury Fame and Shame Awards.
The burgers are better at Hungry Jack's.
Not anymore, they're not.
10 Axes, George Negus at 6:30.
The Australian switches on the paywall.
This is not a short-term strategy, and if it doesn't work in 6 months, we're going to turn around and say, well, that all failed. This is the future of the newspaper.
And the Walkley nominations are...
So with us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Fiona Jolly, CEO of the Advertising Standards Bureau.
Hi, guys.
And podcast producer Colin Delaney.
Hello.
So, Fiona, welcome to the podcast. This is your first outing. For those who don't know, can you explain a bit about the role of the Advertising Standards Bureau?
Okay, so our basic role is to adjudicate on complaints from the community about advertising. And that's advertising across all media, radio, TV, internet, the things that come to your phone, basically ads in any media. And we have a board of 20 members of the community who decide whether the ads that people find disturbing actually do breach or not the industry code of ethics.
Mm. And yeah, we've written a couple of stories about it recently, the trends in complaints. Do you mind going over a bit about that? What are the most complained about ads at the moment?
Okay. Generally, the trends year in really is that the thing that most people complain about is sex in advertising, followed very closely by discrimination in advertising. And what people complaining about there really is how women are represented. So the overall trend really is that of community concern is about how women are presented in advertising in a sexualised manner. That's the thing that most people complain about year in, year out.
Yeah, and also I noticed that sexualisation of children is another big issue.
It is a big issue, and there's two different points here. One is sexualisation of children in the sense of using kids in sexualised images, and what we find is that while people talk about that, there really aren't ads which use children inappropriately. The general concern is, again, that same image, the same issue about using sex in ads and where the kids see it. And that has been demonstrated most in a rise in complaints about outdoor ads. So even though outdoor advertising generally gets a small number of complaints, most complaints now, I think we're up to 20% last year, are about outdoor ads. And they're because people are concerned about sexy issues or sexy images being portrayed on the outdoor, which you can't switch off.
Yeah. And a big issue that this year has been centred around outdoor advertising. There's been a government inquiry into outdoor advertising, whether or not it meets community standards. Now, within that debate, is the very existence of the Ad Standards Bureau has been called into question. Do you think, given that debate, you guys have stood your ground and proved your worth?
Look, we've had a great year, really challenging, and we welcome scrutiny from parliamentary inquiries. And we've come out of these, in our view, really well, both... The House of Reps inquiry and the Senate inquiry both came to the end conclusion, reluctantly, I think, in the case of the Senate one, that advertising is best self-regulated in terms of judging whether community values are being met in advertising. And so both inquiries said that advertising should stay in the hands of the Advertising Standards Bureau with some modifications, but, you know, we're really happy with the outcome, and some of the recommendations we're certainly looking at, and there may well be some further improvements to the system.
And what's the process when a complaint comes in? What happens once it reaches you?
So it comes to us. We do an initial assessment about whether it's something that we'll look at or whether it should be referred, for example, to the TV station directly or to the ACCC. We'll contact the advertiser, let them know there's been a complaint, and the advertiser has opportunity to reply to the complaint, of course. Any complaints that come in, all of them get forwarded to the advertiser as they come in. So there may, and it only takes one complaint to raise a case. Once we've got an advertiser response, we have a board meeting. So we have our 20 members of the community who comprise the board.
And do all of them, or most of them, come to every single board meeting?
We used to have a system where there were 12 members and 12 members came to every meeting. Now we have a bigger pool of people, 20, and we have a roster system. So they don't all come to each meeting because that's just too big. So we generally have 12 people at each meeting, but then we have a couple of meetings a year where everyone comes, where we talk about the trends in decisions and make sure that everyone's up to speed with where recent decisions are.
And when the board talks about a complaint, how long does the conversation... Well, how is the conversation structured and how long does it take?
Well, we start off, we show the ad. The board members sit around the room or else on teleconference we show the ad, and the chair of the meeting then opens the ad up for discussion. Some ads, to be honest, very little conversation because it's really obvious that the ad is fine, or isn't fine, although if it does breach the code, there'll always be quite a bit of conversation about it. The ones that are really interesting are ones where there really is a difference of view, and these can go from, I can think one of the most heated conversations recently was an ad which had a little girl sitting next to a hot plate next to a cooktop, and it was an ad for a cooktop, and the discussion was about whether it was unsafe to show a child sitting next to a cooktop.
And what did the board decide in the end?
The board eventually decided it was okay.
Right, okay.
Yeah, because the whole point of the ad was about the new type of cooktop wasn't hot.
And do these sometimes actually go to a vote?
Yes, quite a lot go to votes now. And it's a simple majority vote with the chair having a casting vote if there's a tie. And so basically they'll look at the ad, they'll look at the code of ethics, and their decision isn't just do you think the ad is okay or not. They have to look at the industry code and decide whether the ad meets the standards set out in the code. So, for example, with sex, the test is, does the ad treat sex, sexuality or nudity with sensitivity to the relevant audience? So the board has to think, okay, sex is not banned, but is it being treated appropriately depending on whether it's, for example, an outdoor ad that everyone's going to see or whether it's on at an M-rated TV show.
Mm. Can I just ask, there seem to be quite a lot of ads that slip through the cracks and get on air, and they really, you wonder how on earth an ad like this, for example, a racist ad or something that does discriminate, was ever allowed to see the light of day. Do you ever get agencies that run ads past you first to just test with you, to sort of pre-test whether they're suitable or appropriate?
Yeah, that's a good question. The ASB doesn't look at ads beforehand, and there isn't a system of pre-vetting ads. We don't think that there should be. We think most advertisers and agencies are pretty much there in terms of working out what's okay or not. I don't think there are very many ads that slip through in the sense of being put on air, obviously breaching community standards. Mm. Quite a lot of the board's decisions, for example, really are around the grey area where you'll have industry groups or the advertiser saying, you know, we really thought this ad was fine, but the board just coming to a view which is like, yeah, we can see how you would have thought it was okay, but, you know, actually it's not.
Mm. I seem to remember that in the UK a few years back, the French Connection, FC UK, got to the point where they were having so many findings against them that they were having to have all of their ads prejudged before they were going up. Do you have a similar sanction here?
We don't here, and it's a decision that we have, a conscious decision not to have that system here. The UK is a much bigger organisation. They have over 100 staff. They have a lot more resources, so they can put that system in place. We're not resourced to have that sort of system here, but we do a lot of behind the scenes chatting with advertisers, particularly ones that have run into trouble with the system. So while we don't formally pre-clear their ads, sometimes they'll ring and sort of say, you know, this is a concept, what do you think? And we'll give them a bit of steering.
The repeat offenders? And I'm thinking of, you know, one that I've noticed over the years is Wicked Camper Vans, where you read the complaint and then you read the response and you get the impression he does not give a toss about advertising standards. In the end, it's a voluntary system and it relies on people being willing. But here this is a small businessman who finds the whole thing quite funny. Most of it, I think a lot of the things that are complained about, he has control of the media, you know, they're billboards at his presence. I mean, I know this is like a guy at the fringes, but there have been a lot of complaints. Mm. I'm not sure, do you have any sanctions that you can look at something like that?
We don't have sanctions, it's a self-regulated system, but in any system, regulated or not, there are people who will decide, bugger it, we're just going to do what we like. But the number of people who do that in the advertising ethics area is very, very small. I can think of Wicked at times have done that. We've got an advertiser in Victoria, Kittens Buses, who've basically put the finger up at us and said, we don't care what you say, this is what we're going to do. We don't have any sanctions, but we work really closely with people that we think might be able to do something.
Would that be media owners who own the
media
space,
owners, although in the case of Wicked and the Kittens Bus in Melbourne, they're not people who work with media. So in that case, we have some liaison with the police. With the case of the Kittens Bus in Victoria, we're liaising with the Victorian government to see if there's something that they can do.
I'm not familiar with the Kittens Bus.
Oh, it's a bit like Wicked. It's a big bus. They have a scantily clad, sexually posed woman down the whole side of the bus. They have it stopped at intersections. They just drive it around, and then there's a fair bit of angst in the community about it. And it's an ad for strip clubs.
Okay. Yeah. And from the other side of things, and you mentioned earlier that it takes one complaint to trigger an investigation, time wasters. You look at some of them, and certainly my impression is that sometimes the people who complain, there's a wider issue going on. It's not actually about the ad. It's that they don't approve of the product, yep. or just, you know, I'm trying to find a nice way to say it, but they're mad. I guess a lot of time goes in from your staff's point of view, but from the brands as well.
That's right. 2 years ago, we introduced a new process, which is a process where we won't send complaints that we think is something that is consistently dismissed by the board. We won't raise a case. Where we're a bit up in the air about whether it really fits in that category, though, we'll send it in the board just to be cautious. So you would see over the last 2 years less of the spurious sort of complaints actually going to the board, which is good. But we have to be careful that we're not prejudging. You know, if people have taken the time to write to us and put in a complaint, we have to make sure that we're actually really giving them the benefit of the doubt and raising a case, unless it's really obvious that it's just something that's really personal to them that the rest of the community isn't really going to have a concern about, or they are someone who just has read something into an ad that a reasonable person isn't going to see.
I wondered almost if it's the price of self-regulation that, you know, you have to deal with that sort of thing.
Well, then it's not just self-regulation, really. The same thing will apply to any complaints-driven agency. So ACCC and Fair Trading will have the same issues about having to make a judgment call on whether to put resources into pursuing a complaint or politely rejecting it.
Now, a big news story, and in fairness, it broke before you were asked to rule either way, was the outdoor campaign that AdShell declined for the Queensland Association of Health Communities, the rip and roll campaign, which it featured kind of two gay guys in an embrace. It was relatively mild, but there were complaints from the Australian Christian lobby, and that was enough to have it initially taken down. When lobbying happens, you must see this kind of presence of lobbying. Do you feel under more pressure than you would from a single complaint, for instance?
No, only in the sense that once it gets in the media, of course we get media calls and we're asked to try and prejudge the board's decision. But Rip and Roll was a fantastic experience to go through and will be a fantastic case study for advertising students for years to come, I think. And what it really showed was the power of social media. And, you know, we had 15 or 20 complaints from people, and we could tell that there were people from a particular moral viewpoint, but there's a process to go through. But what we found was that 15, 20 complaints was met by something like 70,000 people who joined up to the website complaining about the ad being taken down.
And then there was a protest, wasn't there?
There's a video shot of
the actual process. It really snowballed.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing. And one of the things that's interesting, and particularly on the next topic going into around the sort of whole junk food issue, is that the silent majority in Australia who don't complain or don't bother saying, look, that ad's fine, until they can see the sort of freedom of speech being taken away from them, and then they'll get up the, you know, they'll bother to say, hang on, we don't think you should be censoring what we're seeing.
Next, should we drop TV's local content quota?
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Now, in Monday's media section of The Australian, Matt Baxter, CEO of media agency UM, called for a drop in TV's local content quota. Well, called for it to be dropped altogether on the back of Australian television performing so well that it wasn't needed anymore. Matt Baxter told The Oz, "Today many people believe these quotas are still necessary. I am not one of them. And judging by the stellar ratings of locally produced programming, neither is the average Australian. Nowadays, locally produced programming accounts for about 95% of Australia's top 20 TV programmes. For those who don't know, the quota is something that's been around for a number of years. It's a condition of having the TV licences, the broadcasting licences, is a certain amount of Australian-made content. Now, Colin, you wrote an opinion piece for our sister title, Encore, about Matt Baxter's statement and the state of the industry. Do you think we don't need the safety net anymore?
I think we certainly do still need the safety net. The Australian content, when you consider just drama only, so, you know, Packed to the Rafters, Underbelly, makes up about 7.8% of the hours of drama on TV. UK is more, it's about 9.3% of hours. And US content, drama only, takes up 81%.
But you're being selective with your facts, though, aren't you? Because if you took across, you know, news and current affair programming and things like Sunrise and Today and the news bulletins and everything else, there would be far more Australian-made content.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. But being that he's, I guess, you know, you can rule out news and current affairs, but I think his point was these shows like X Factor, which are doing well. And, yeah, I don't think it's at a point to take the safety net out from under us just yet.
I mean, one of the arguments is that, you know, you would get less of shows like Underbelly, Pack to the Rafters, Wild Boys, big expensive Australian shows, because an equivalent hour of US TV would be just so much cheaper to buy in. But the argument that Matt Baxter makes, and he sort of joined in the comment thread on it, is that actually something like Underbelly, even if you add in the extra costs, that still is more profitable for the network than an hour of something franchised in, you know, whether it's CSI or whatever.
Yeah, it seems it's obviously a story about protectionism. I wonder what the original reason was for introducing such a regulation. It was presumably to protect the Australian, Australian culture, locally made shows, local production companies, right? And production companies seem to be doing okay, don't they? I mean, is there any reason why that this law should still be in place?
Yeah, I'm being devil's advocate with Colin, but actually, I'm kind of on his side. I mean, as much as anything, you know, the TV licenses are given the spectrum in order to make an awful lot of money. That's, you know, and the deal is, in return, give us some Australian culture as well. Don't just make money the most easy and straightforward way. Give something back. That's the deal.
I think, case in point is the commercial multi-channels. If you look at those, there's no quota on the multi-channels. And as a result, we've got shows like Swamp People.
I grew up, in the swamps down here, learned how to hunt and fish when I was little bitty. Ready? You pumped up? I want my kids to learn the same thing and to respect the swamp, love the swamp and who they are and where they come from.
That was a clip from Swamp People.
Yes.
Very inspiring.
And it sounds pretty awesome. Some slack-jawed yokels. Foreign content on our screens, the Convergence report has stated, has gone up by 154% since 2008, whereas local content has only risen a third of that. It's pretty obvious that we're not out of the woods just yet for this safety net to be removed.
Fiona. It's really important, especially for kids and young people, to actually see some Australian content and not just be able to switch on any channel and just be subject to American quality shows. And, I mean, the broadcasters are all saying we're going to keep producing the content anyway, in which case, well, there's no harm in keeping the quota because they're going to keep meeting it anyway. So let's just keep it there as a safety net because who knows what the commercial pressures will put on.
Next, the Parents' Jury Fame and Shame Awards.
As Mumbrella reported last week, Kellogg's has launched a preemptive PR campaign against lobby group The Parents' Jury and its Fame and Shame Awards, which has led to some bad press for Kellogg's over the years. A Kellogg statement read, "We are sure these items have not been deliberately posted to be deceptive, but we believe it is vital we defend our proud 80-year heritage from potentially misleading communications." This year, both LCM and Cocoa Pops have been nominated for the Pester Power Award and Nutri-Grain for Smoke and Mirrors. Basically, these categories mean that Kellogg's are using the communications in untoward ways to target children. So McDonald's, on the other hand, which also gets a bad press by these awards, this week told Mumbrella that it was ignoring them and wouldn't be launching any sort of PR attack around them. So, Tim, do you think Kellogg's did the right thing, or should they have stayed quiet like McDonald's?
Do you know, I normally argue that, yes, brands should, if there's widespread complaint that's going to reach the ears of consumers and they've got a different perspective, then come out and say it. And coming out and saying it first is even more sensible, because it means at the point at which people are writing about it, there's already something out there that, you know, that they're not even having to chase a response. They're not chasing the story. It's already out there. So I think that's kind of worked fine for them. The only thing that makes me slightly cautious about that is I'd have probably said the same thing about Solaris Paper and their responding to the attacks from Greenpeace when they took out the full page ads in the papers, and regular listeners of the podcast might remember that didn't go terribly well for them.
Yeah, and it's also worth pointing out that Kellogg's also has a new PR manager, PR director in Gareth Lucy, and also has its first PR agency for some time. So it looks like they're being very proactive. They've got a brief out early. They know that the Fame and Shame Awards has hurt them previously, and they're doing something about it before it gets in the press. Regular Mumbrella reader Ad Grunt jokingly nominated Parents Jury for Longevity in Denying Fat Kid Problem is Parental Laziness or Stupidity Award. So Fiona, at what point does the Ad Standards Bureau say this is a parent's duty to step in and not ours?
Well, look, the Advertising Standards Board and Bureau don't really have a view on what the parents' role
is. Can I just interrupt? Because I've always wondered quite what the difference is. Because I must confess, for the last 3 years, I've just interchanged the two. Really.
Well, the board is the decision maker, the panel of 20 people who make the decisions. The Bureau is the organisation, the secretariat, and I'm the head of the secretariat. The parental laziness, I mean, you know, in my personal view as the working mum with four kids under 12, my kids don't get in the car and drive down to the local fast food store. They go there because I take them. And I don't take them very often, but probably oftener than they should go.
Do you come back with a happy meal when you do?
Absolutely. kids don't drive themselves to those stores. Their parents do. And it's up to parents to educate children about, that there are no good and bad foods. It's all about moderation and healthy diet and exercise. But in terms of what the Advertising Standards Board does, we look at whether the ads meet the standards that industries set. And the issue around quick service foods being advertised has become more complex or more regulated since the new QSR initiative came into place 2 years ago. And under that initiative, the quick service restaurant industry said, we won't advertise directly to kids unless we're advertising the healthier product. So what you'll have seen over the past couple of years is a really big change in the ads that are directed to kids. So your Happy Meal ads now will only show the chicken wrap, the healthy choice product. You don't see Happy Meal ads for nuggets and fries. And you also don't see kids' ads dominated by the toys. They're a very, very small part of the kids' ads these days.
And you also don't see the more general chain ads running during times of kids' programming, except when there's usually it seems to be a blunder when they're doing make goods or something.
Yeah, well, and this is really the key issue that organisations like the Parents Jury and the Cancer Council raise a point about, is that the quick service and the other grocery initiatives regulate and constrain the type of ads that can be shown during kids' programming to kids. But it's the 6:30 to 8:30 time slot where really there's a lot of controversy at the moment, because the initiatives about restricting what kids see is only in the kid-focused programs. It's not in general family time viewing. So,
and I've seen a fair number of complaints come in where people feel that something like the X Factor, that the complaint will be kids can see it during that. So
that's right.
You get a sense there's a difference between the rules and what perceptions may be from a proportion of parents about what should be on. There's a difference between the two.
In this area, we get very, very few complaints from a parent. We get complaints from the parents' jury or from other health lobby groups. And their concern is mostly in that 6:30 to 8:30 shows that are attractive to kids and have relatively high child viewing audiences but aren't directed to kids. So like The X Factor, MasterChef, The Simpsons, Home and Away. A lot of kids watch them, but they're not shows that are primarily directed to kids.
Do you think the board might in time move on that?
It's not up to the board. The board only regulates what can only make its decisions against what the industry codes say. There is pressure now. Certainly the parents' jury and the Cancer Councils will be saying that they're putting pressure on the industry to say regulate and make more strict what you can show in that family viewing time, but that's not the case at the moment.
Have you ever been pestered by your kids, Fiona, as a result of an ad that they've seen on the TV?
Look, I think every parent has, but, you know, who's the boss in the house? Mum.
Right, yeah. So what do you say to them?
Just say, well, that's fine, and sometimes you can have that, but, you know, not right now. Or, you know, we have, I mean, the four of my kids gang up on me. So if we're out and about shopping or, you know, doing sport or whatever on Saturday, and we'll sort of yell out, what do we have for lunch, kids? And their current mantra is KFC. The four of them, the, you know, the big ones go, tell Mum KFC, tell Mum KFC. You know, sometimes we get KFC, sometimes we go and have a roll and sit down the park.
Which leads nicely on to our next segment. Next, did Clemenger DDB make Hungry Jack's better?
Thinking of working at an ad agency? Looking for the best creatives to develop your next ad campaign? Look no further than the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. 148 pages of hardcore industry intelligence to help you make your next big agency decision. Visit book.focalattractions.com.au/MCAR.
In the wake of adding veggies to the menu, Hungry Jack's have ditched the burgers are better slogan after 16 years as they head into a new, healthier route. The new slogan will be Hungry Jack's makes it better. Let's have a listen.
7,000 head of cattle. You reckon they'd be hard to lose?
Where the bloody hell are they? But we farm them organically. That way they walk wherever they like.
Here we go, here's one. That'll be the boy's idea of a joke.
Hungry Jack's is now buying my organic beef.
But with a station as big as some European countries, I gotta find them first.
Introducing new country burgers made with 100% organic beef. Part of the new Better Taste menu at Hungry Jack's.
So, Robin, new slogan, better?
Yeah, not for me. I think they've unnecessarily thrown away quite a lot of valuable brand equity. I really like the slogan simply because I think, actually, the burgers are better at Hungry Jack's. And for me, the new slogan is just a bit too generic. Hungry Jack's makes it better. It sounds a bit like a father who's consoling his child that's fallen over. You know, I mean, there. It's all better now. It doesn't have the punch or that sort of alliterative appeal of the old slogan.
I mean, the defence I would give of it is obviously you've got a sort of double meaning in that, you know, they're making stuff better in how they're making it, and also, you know, the experience better. So you can see that they're trying to come, you know, build on the brand before and take it beyond burgers. So you can strategically you can understand why.
Yeah.
But of course, one or two of the critics on the comment thread have pointed out new agency. What often happens when a new agency is, you know, the old slogan's ditched and a new one comes in.
Yeah, I did get the sort of double meaning, and I like the fact that they've kept the word better, which the marketing director pointed out. Is, you know, that they haven't thrown away all of that equity. But for me, yeah, it just sounds as if another burger chain jumping on a bandwagon to appear healthier than actually they are.
Now, Fiona, in the new campaign, they're promoting their meat as organically farmed and that makes their burgers better and comes with a certified organic sticker. When it comes to those sort of claims, certified and we don't maybe know by who and all of those things, how involved do you get in that side of things?
Generally, we don't look at truth and accuracy, but under the AANA Food and Beverages Code, there is a requirement that ads for food have to be truthful and they can't be misleading and they have to present information in a way that is going to be understood by a reasonable consumer. We obviously won't look at this unless we get a complaint, but we have had complaints along similar type of things. For example, when the new Coles meat campaign came out, we had a few complaints about that, and we will look at those because under the food code we have to, but it's up to the advertiser to show us that they've got documentation to say that it would meet organic standards, whether there are actually organic standards or not, and basically to substantiate the claims they've made.
Colin, healthy, good? So that wasn't really much of a question, was it?
No.
Colin, healthy, good. I'm becoming so lazy, I'm not even bothering with whole sentences anymore.
That's all right. I'll just answer in one-word responses. Look, as far as the campaign goes, I'm just disappointed that Hungry Jack's goes this route. I mean, I think leave it to McDonald's. I understand that Hungry Jack's are probably relatively unhealthy for me, but... I'm willing to take that chance when I'm hungover because a Whopper is really good. And I just feel like you don't go out for a burger to be healthy. I did a little case study of my own a while back, an article on, you know, the best burgers in Sydney. And I found as far as these, you know, gourmet burger bars around Sydney goes, the one that claims to be the healthiest was actually the least satisfying, least tasty. I had none of the drip that rolls down your arm, that juice and fat and, you know, the stuff that is delicious. So in my opinion, and this is just, you know, as the consumer, I kind of feel like let McDonald's take the healthy route and just be a burger joint. Like, just be greasy.
Is there a gap in the market emerging for an unashamedly, you know, an unashamedly indulgent burger, I wonder?
But surely it doesn't hurt to have a few of the healthy choices, because if you're, you know, the family situation, the kids want to go, mum might be more inclined to, and I say mum meaning myself, not necessarily being assuming that mums always make those decisions, but, you know, if you can think, oh, at least I can take the kids, they can have the burger, oh, but there might be something that's a bit healthier or a bit, you know, more okay for whatever diet I want at the time from that store, rather than just saying, no, we'll all go to Subway.
Next, the week in TV.
It was announced this week that Ten will pull the plug on 6:30pm with George Negus. In its place, a 7pm project will run for an hour, beginning at 6:30, and be renamed The Project. Ten have said there'll be no redundancies, as Ten are due to launch their new show, Breakfast, and said the cancellation in no way reflected on the crew or Negus himself, who has anchored the likes of Nine's Today, 60 Minutes and ABC's Foreign Correspondent for long tenures. So, Tim, why do you think that the show didn't work?
I'm really sad it didn't work. Big credit to Ten. They stuck with it for nearly a year without great ratings. You know, this is when networks will take a show off after 2 weeks for middling ratings. And, you know, a couple of big experiments Ten have done. 7pm Project, you know, pretty dire ratings to begin with, and it clawed back. And, you know, there are many days when it's not doing more than 700,000 viewers, but it's become a solid franchise and it's a competitor. And that's because they stuck with it. They probably made a small mistake to begin with, starting it with 6pm with George Negus. So they had this sort of slightly muddled thing of, you know, there was a news bulletin, then there was half an hour of Negus, then there was another news bulletin. And in the end, things improved slightly when they moved Negus to 6:30. I find it massively depressing that Today Tonight and A Current Affair draw more viewers, you know, because they're very, very populist, but clearly that's what the Australian audience wants. Would have been lovely if Ten had, you know, stuck with it longer, but I understand why they haven't. You know, it wasn't the ABC or SBS, but it was reasonably high-end, intelligent news that attempted to bring the outside world to their viewers. So, you know, I'm depressed and can't explain why it didn't work, and it very rarely got above 500,000, so it didn't. But unfortunately, it does say something about Australian TV viewers.
Is it just a matter of falling between not being quite hard-hitting enough as the 7:30 report and not being salacious enough for those that like A Current Affair and Today Tonight?
I mean, some of it is the audience as well. Ten has got the youngest skewing audience, so, you know, arguably you can't go after the likes of, you know, an ABC audience, an SBS audience, if you're on Ten and you're sitting next to the 7pm project, you know, because some of that established audience has also just crossed over to watch Neighbours. And that's the other thing to remember, is the thing that made room for it was when Neighbours and the Simpsons were moved to Ten's digital channel 11 for the launch of that. So some of that audience did peel away. So actually, if you look at the kind of audiences that Neighbours and the Simpsons were doing before the digital channel, overall, Ten have probably come out slightly ahead. But George Negus is, what, about 70, I think? You know, is he the right choice for that audience? I don't know. Certainly had gravitas. Not many people were saying beforehand it didn't work, so I think it's a bit cynical for people to be wise after the event, you know, because most people quite like the look of it, I think.
And what about the project from Roving Enterprise? Do you think more news light?
Yeah, I mean, as a half-hour thing, it's always been this sort of, you know, magazine-y, but with news thing. We're going to see more of the same. We'll see George Negus as one of the regular panellists on it as well. That's a pretty good format. You know, I mean, I think, it's changed since it first launched as well. And obviously the presenters just got more comfortable in it, you know. So that's found its way. And it's, you know, and it's the thing I like about it is it's original Australian programming, you know, and there's not enough of it.
Mm. Fiona, any thoughts on News Digest sort of shows? What's your favourite?
Well, it's interesting, Tim, what you're saying about who's watching it, because, you know, I'm a certain age, four kids under 11, I don't sit down in front of the telly until 8:30 at night.
Mm, right.
So if there's lots of other people my sort of demographic, the time's completely wrong because I'm lucky to see the news before 9:30 at night.
And do you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Australia, if you look at, say, the US or the UK, there are big rating sort of mid to late evening news bulletins that do really well. And we don't actually have that in Australia at all.
No, well, 9:30 we switch to SBS. That's the only channel you can get news on unless you stay up till 10:30 for the... I don't know if it's even still on, the Channel 10 news. Yeah.
Yes, now there's been some... There has been some movement, and obviously Nine got rid of their late news a while back as well. You know, there again, I suppose, there is now on Freeview ABC News 24, that's not bringing in big audiences yet. And I must admit, I'm... the only thing that's keeping me subscribed to Foxtel at the moment, since my building stopped getting Foxtel IQ, is Sky News.
Yeah, and it's just worth pointing out, again, back to the ratings, that pay TV had its highest ever rating during the Aussie-Kiwi World Cup match with 719,000 viewers, which isn't bad at all.
Yes, as it happens, it beats in pay TV homes. It narrowly beat Nine's coverage,
yes,
which is probably a relative first as well. So overall, Nine did, from memory, I think it was about 1.7 million, 1.8 yes. million. But in pay TV only homes, it was just under 700,000 for Nine. So, you know, a lot of people, given the choice, chose to go for pay TV.
Yeah.
Is that a bit out of the frustration, do you think, of Nine's poor programming of quote-unquote live rugby games?
Yeah, there were problems early on where live rugby wasn't really live. I mean, even during that semi, I tweeted about it and had loads of responses from people because I started with Nine's coverage and they were trying to squeeze in ad breaks, you know, every time the play stopped. And coming back and, you know, having missed the first two or three seconds of action. So in the end, I switched over to Fox Sports 3, where it was showing. And kind of when I mentioned this on Twitter, most people were... their view was, you idiot, why didn't you just start there in the first place? But I actually enjoyed Ray Hadley's coverage, which I know not many people did, but I thought he was quite... I enjoyed his commentary style, but...
Yeah. And just rounding up the week, the Big Bang Theory won Monday night for Nine. And which the station also bumped the Joy of Sets for Mike and Molly on Tuesday night. And we saw that Pack to the Rafters again won on Tuesday night.
Shame about Joy of Sets. That was a Zapruder's Other Films production. Same people who do The Grand Transfer, yeah, of course. And it was a similar, I guess, you know, different world, but trying to sort of peep behind the curtain a little bit. Shame it went very quickly. You know, we talk about the example of stations pulling things swiftly. It wasn't rating great, but it wasn't actually getting a big run in from the shows that were going beforehand. Mike and Molly, pretty average US sitcom, also rated badly as well. So you know, we've got a badly rating US sitcom replacing, you know, a badly rating at least it was local programming.
Next, the Australian's paywall.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones.
Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves.
Check out the case study for Nissan Microcitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at cradiodifferently.com.
Next week, The Australian should finally switch on its paywall. I've been chatting to its editor, Clive Matheson.
Now, one of the experiences elsewhere in the world is, of course, audiences are reduced in size.
Of course.
Purely because people are being asked to pay for it.
Yeah.
Is there a risk that you lose influence as a result?
The people who'll tell you that are often commentators who are really worried about, you know, sort of their audience shrinking effectively. And I remember talking to The Times before they, you know, went to their premium content model, and they were saying, you know, if we lose 95% of our audience, we'll be very happy with that result. And at the time, that was just horrifying to me that's the numbers that they were talking about. But, you know, with our premium strategy and the subscribers that we are targeting to become subscribers of our digital platform, they're the people who are the decision makers, they're the people of influence, they're the people who are interested in those topics. They're the people we want to reach anyway, so we'll still have influence in the right areas of, say, national affairs, of business and other areas. The story should resonate out, you know, beyond our website effectively, you know, if the news is strong enough. So, look, that's not something that worries me. You know, I think the Australian is influential in the right areas, and I think it will continue to be, you know, no matter where we put the content.
Tim, so do you think it'll work?
Yes, I do, but mainly because I think the Australian's taking quite a small, controlled risk. So as a result, arguably the prize might be smaller as well. If you look in other parts of the world, the UK, the US, quite different online advertising markets. For instance, The Times, which is also owned by News Corp, went 100% paywall. But the reason that they could think, well, we might as well do it, we haven't got much to lose, is they were bringing in pretty small advertising revenues. You know, there are less decent dollars to be had in the UK when it comes to online advertising. You know, you won't get a cost per thousand of $50. You know, it'll be nearer $1. So that meant it was an easy decision. Anything they do that brings in revenue, probably a good thing. Here in Australia, the Australian probably does okay for advertising revenue, so they can't afford to lose that. So I think that's one of the reasons why they've gone for this decision of what they call freemium. So some free stuff, some premium stuff. The idea being that, for the sake of argument, they sell out 70% of their advertising inventory at the moment, then so long as they still give away 70% of their content for free, they'll keep every single advertising dollar. But if they can start charging just a few people to see the other 30% of the high-end quality stuff, the opinion stuff, the analysis stuff, you know, whatever they think that it is that makes the Australian distinct and unique rather than AAP copy or whatever, then those are all extra dollars. But, of course, because they're only going after that 30%, as I say, the prize is smaller, but equally, you know, from early on, it's new revenue.
Yeah, and the model that they're following is the model of The Times. Obviously, I've read somewhere that the most successful paywall ever erected was for the Wall Street Journal in the US. And one of the advantages they had was doing it very, very early on.
Yes.
So the readers were used to it.
Yeah, although don't forget, early doesn't always work. So the AFR did it early here in Australia. Most people would probably argue that's not been a success. Although most people would also argue that it was priced wrongly at $1,000, you know, something like $1,000 for a year. So obviously very much at people who, you know, it's business and that's what they're going to be doing it for. So smaller numbers. And the one difference in the pricing structure, you're quite right, is very similar to The Times. The one difference is I think there'll be far less behind the paywall here in Australia than there is for The Times in the UK, which is everything.
Yeah. So Fiona, can I ask you, are you a reader of The Australian? If you are, would you pay for the content online, which used to be free?
The Weekend Australian would be probably paid to look at the jobs.
Right.
Not very much, but a little bit.
Yes.
The jobs. Yeah. Oh, dear. What does that say?
For the kids, right?
Yeah, of course. probably not.
But not news. You're so used getting news for free online that you wouldn't pay for it.
Most of the news that I look at is 10 or 15 minutes of work online.
Yeah, what are your media habits? How do you consume your media?
The radio on the way to work at the moment, and then 10 or 15
always the
minutes.
Same station? Or?
Yeah, because with the kids in the car, you have to pick the stations you can listen to. And and then 10 or 15 minutes at work on a news channel.
Next, the Walkley nominations.
The Walkley Foundation this week announced the general finalists in all categories. A few categories had already been announced. So News Limited came out on top with 30 nominations, beating rivals ABC, who secured 25 nominations, while Fairfax received 17.
Yeah, and one thing to point out, of course, on those numbers as well is that it depends how you slice it. I would imagine if you broke them into individual titles, and I haven't done this, but my guess would be the SMH, a Fairfax title, would come out top. So there are many different ways of slicing it. And, of course, it's one of those ones that there are all sorts of intriguing categories, of which the one that always sits a bit oddly with me is, and I know sub-editors are people too, but the ones for best headline.
Yeah, no, it struck me. I read, though, I actually, in defence of the category, I think to draw the reader in, you need a great headline. It's absolutely a viable category. Some of the nominations, I wasn't that impressed by.
Go on, run through a few.
A couple. All of Twitter, the Hurley Bird should have seen the warning signs. Obviously, play on Liz Hurley and Shane Warne. But yeah, no, it just seemed a bit weak. And also, there's no category for media journalism, which I thought, do you think there should have been?
No, there's a business journalism category, so I'd argue, yeah, too narrow and self-interested.
Yes, right.
Speaking as a media journalist. I guess my issue with the sub-business one is I understand totally a good headline is essential, but most walklies are given for something that's taken at the very least days, if not weeks, of work and investigation and talking to people and digging.
Yeah, a sub should be able to knock out a headline in 2 minutes, right?
Yeah, well, or an hour or two if it comes down to it. Yeah. If it's the front page and it's an amazing, you know, and it's an amazingly great headline. And there have been some great headlines over the years. But
your favourite ever headline?
A few. There's the famous football one, Supercaligo-Ballistic Celtic are atrocious.
Yeah, explain the football teams.
Yeah, so that was Caledonian Thistle and Celtic, and Caledonian Thistle had obviously beaten Celtic. there was, I guess, the classic one, a News Corps title, The Sun, the day that George Michael was caught in inauspicious circumstances in a men's toilet. Zip me up before you go, which was another just classic tabloid headline. And I guess one of the most famous headlines of all time, which is, you know, reviled as much as it was respected also from The Sun, was just Britain during the Falklands War with Gotcha, the day that it sank a boat and hundreds of people died. But summed up something about the kind of the febrile atmosphere at the time. You know, it captures readers in a way that, you know, I'm not sure our tabloids here in Australia are quite doing in the same mould as Kelvin McKenzie, but there are many people who would say that's a good thing.
Yeah. So who do you think of the lot in the running at the moment looks likely to win? And over the years, has it been dominated by one media company in particular? Or?
The perception from News Limited is that it's dominated by Fairfax and the ABC, which is one of the reasons why News Limited has its own internal awards and puts a lot of effort into making it a really big deal for the whole company. And you're generally, certainly last time, pretty much the whole Murdoch family came to the country to be there for it. Although, yeah, it is interesting that News Limited have actually come at top, at least on the shortlisting stage. So we'll have to see. What I'll be fascinated by is how The Australian actually fares, because it's had a very, very controversial year. You know, sort of Chris Mitchell, the editor-in-chief, has probably been under the spotlight, you know, more than ever before, and been part of the story more than ever before. And, you know, will we see some vindication for some of the, you know, some of their big stories?
Mm. Fiona, Mumbrella, we love writing stories about the Ad Standards Bureau.
Yeah, I do, and we love that you do.
Are there any newspapers out of the mainstream press, any newspapers that tend to love your stories more than others? And presumably, you've got you've got a very good media relations person who is excellent about getting that news out.
The Adelaide Advertiser loves to do stories on us. And there's quite a few of the Sunday papers around who'd like to do it. It's a nice, easy filler to do a bit of a story about some of the recent cases.
And the end of year roundup for the Stats.
Oh, that's always a big hit everywhere. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's. I know it's the point. The Christmas party season is nearly over at the time that one comes in. It's it's just one of the things that Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without the end of the year.
Well, we're up on that now. So we plan out top 10 early in December now, so we don't have our Christmas parties interrupted by the journos.
Colin.
I don't have any real headlines that have been standout, but one of the few people I follow on Twitter is The Onion, and they're always good for a laugh, which I thought I'd share a few.
Please
fake
do.
Headlines.
Yes, I love The Onion.
Yeah, so terrible father gets that promotion. report, all the good seashells taken. And one, a little crass, and I apologise.
And yet you're going to read it anyway.
Yeah, indeed. Silvio Berlusconi gets penis stuck in wine bottle, stuck in prostitute.
Well, on that highbrow note, that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Fiona.
Thank you.
To Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.